Recording in progress.
Good afternoon slash evening, or whatever time you're in. Thanks for coming out here on this wintry night. So last week, Christopher talked to us about chapter 5 of the Dhammapada, and he gave us a homework assignment, and I said everybody should do it because I would ask you about it this week. And maybe nobody did it, but I'm going to ask if anybody has anything to say. And the homework assignment was to attend to the verse in the Dhammapada that says, look not to the faults of others, look to your own faults. So I'm wondering if anybody has some comments about that or anything they noticed this past week, or anything they just noticed when I started talking about it. Yeah, Michael.
Well, just today I noticed a couple of episodes where I got very irritated with people, someone swimming in my lane who just launched himself in and started swimming in the opposite direction.
You must be talking about a pool.
No, yes. 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 Anyway, I went through some irritation and said something to him, but what I noticed was the irritation just made me feel so bad. I just got upset and felt bad, and not because of anything I said to him. I was polite and so forth, but it just made me feel bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And upset, and so it came back to me. It's like, don't look at the faults of others. It's like as much about me and what I'm going through.
Yeah. Thank you. Even if the other person is doing something that you could call a fault, focusing on it doesn't feel very good.
Yeah.
Anyone else? Yeah, Greg.
I find that I don't have to focus to notice other people's faults. It happens spontaneously. However, I can focus on looking at myself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a huge difference between the two aspects of this. And that's more or less what I try to do, but it's a losing game if we're not going to see faults. And I'm hoping that over time that they will kind of wither away, that spontaneous fault.
Thank you. Well, it doesn't say don't see the faults of others. It says maybe don't focus on them. And it's true. I don't think any of us have to focus on them for them to come up in our minds, unfortunately. I had an experience that I was talking to a friend of mine who was kind of on a rant about a mutual acquaintance who she was very upset with. Is the sound? Somebody online is playing some music, maybe. So anyway, I was a little distressed at her negativity, and then I started thinking, well, I need to be compassionate towards her because this person hurt her, and there's lots of reasons why she's saying these things. And then I thought again of the homework assignment, and I thought, well, right, that's a good thing to do, to be compassionate to other people, but this is slightly different, this idea of not even looking to her faults and just turning the attention back to myself, and that at some level, what she's doing is her business, and I can let go of it, and I don't have to be all tangled up in it. So that was kind of a nice feeling to just drop back from something negative going on. Sometimes, of course, you have to attend to it, you have to do something about it, but there's a way that we can learn not to get quite so personally involved and tangled up, I think.
One online.
I can't see the whole.
It's
Marianne, I believe.
Okay. Marianne?
Yeah. Well, sometimes I notice it helps me, because I regularly find other people's faults. I mean, people irritate me. But if I'm able to sometimes kind of think about it a little more, and I, the disconcerting thing is that I notice, oh, I do that too, somewhat differently, but I do some piece of that. And that helps me feel a little more compassionate to the person, so that then if I do need to say something about it, I have a better grounding for meeting, because I kind of understand, because I do somewhat similarly. So that's something that helps me when I remember, which isn't like so much.
Well, that's great. That's a good one. Are we doing the same thing? Okay. Thank you. John, is there a way to make it? See, I can't see that band is keeping me from seeing what's happening.
So Bruce
and
Jane.
Bruce.
Can you hear me okay?
Not very well. Oh, wait. Okay, try again, Bruce.
About now, a little better?
That's better.
All right. My approach to this homework is kind of much sense, excuse me, everybody's trying the best they can. And that's my approach, and that includes me too. And I find that's helpful. A little bit less judgmental.
Yeah.
And a little bit like you were saying, man. So don't get all tangled up. This is what's happening. Everyone's trying the best they can.
Yeah.
May or may not understand that, but I appreciate it. I try to. I like that. And I like that approach for me better than the, you know, looking for the faults in others and seeing the faults in myself. I think the fault is that we're not good enough. And we're all good enough. And we're also still crazy after all these years.
Well, thank you, Bruce. I think that idea that everybody's doing the best they can is an excellent thing to keep coming back to about yourself too, when you're blaming yourself from some terrible thing. Could it be that somebody online is not muted or something? Well, anyway. Anyway.
You are limbering and making your vocal muscles pliable and responsive.
You did not know you were doing that.
Okay. Well, he's doing the best he can at this very moment. Yes, Patricia.
I don't know if anybody else notices that
others. If needed, you can repeat any
sort of muffled. Yeah. And,
my voice is.
Yeah, so it might be something to do with the speaker or the microphone.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're talking
to a pillow. Oh, yeah. Now, is that better? Okay, good. Is that loud enough, though? Okay, much better then. Okay, and all right, now, again, John, I can't see if anybody's hands are up or not because of that band. It keeps going back to that from gallery. It doesn't stay in gallery. But anyway, anybody else has a hand up? No. Jane did, but doesn't.
I was just calling out that Bruce's hand was up. And
Thank you, Jane. Okay, well, let's turn to the Dhammapada and to chapter, I'm going to be talking about chapters 6 and 7 tonight. Ooh. And I've been enjoying studying the Dhammapada and really coming to see it as being a kind of warm-hearted sutra trying to help us. And it sounds very stern sometimes, but it's really trying to be encouraging. So I'm going to be reading through the verses in these two chapters, but stopping periodically to make comments or make a long digression. But first, I wanted to say a little bit about how the Dhammapada comes to us. And it seems like a miracle, actually, that we have it, because the teachings were passed on orally for hundreds and hundreds of years, for about 450 years, without being written down. So, as you probably know, Ananda, who was Buddha's beloved disciple and attending him at all times, was there listening very hard to everything the Buddha said. And a few months after Buddha's death, there was the first Buddhist council, and Ananda recited at that time all of the teachings of the Pali Canon that he had in his mind. And that included the Dhammapada. From then on, they were passed on orally. And then it was at the fourth Buddhist council, I believe, in 29 BC, 450 years later, or 10 or 12 generations later, that they were finally written down on palm leaves. So that was a long time. And then the oral tradition continued along with the written tradition for a while. But I wondered about this for a long time, because how is this possible? In English translation, the Dhammapada is 1,600, I mean, not the Dhammapada, the Pali Canon is 16,000 pages long, which is an awful lot to memorize. And could such a body of teachings be memorized? Is it really possible? Well, apparently so, or we wouldn't have these teachings, or in some way they got passed on without being written down. And scholars believe that actually sometimes one person memorized one part and one person memorized another part, and they passed them along that way. And that's a technique I use myself when somebody tells me a phone number I need to remember and I have nothing to write it down on. I ask my friend who's standing next to me, oh, could you remember the last four numbers and I'll remember the first six? So that's my version of passing on the Pali Canon, but getting help. So also the Iliad and the Odyssey were passed on orally for hundreds of years after the Pali Canon, a few hundred years after Buddha's time. The same thing happened with the Iliad and the Odyssey. And they were finally written down about 1750 BC. No, wait. That preceded the Pali Canon. 750 BC is before 29 BC, yes. So, but when they were written down, that was just when the Greek alphabet was established. There wasn't even a Greek alphabet before that. And both the Pali Canon and the Iliad and the Odyssey use a lot of patterns of rhyme, rhythm, repetition. We've seen how repetitive the Dhammapada is. And these were all partly of taking some poetic form and partly also as aids to memorization. And now our memory doesn't get anything like the exercise that people's memory got back then. Most people weren't literate. Most people didn't have writing implements. They didn't have palm leaves all prepared to write something down on. And they didn't have as many things battering at their brains all day long as we do. And so they probably had a little more space inside their heads to remember something. We have very little space to put things in there. At least by this time in my life, I feel like I've run out of room. and besides, we don't have to remember anything anyway because we just look it up, which I think is and helpful, but it's also something is lost in the idea of honoring a scholar who studied a particular subject, and you think, oh, I mean, I remember times 50 years ago or whatever, when somebody had a question about, well, who said that in the Shakespeare play? And then the other person, oh, we've got to call up so-and-so because he's a Shakespeare scholar and he could tell us. So there was a different kind of honoring of knowledge and information in a way, but now it's sort of all equal. But it's also very helpful, I will concede. So in the early days, it was, excuse me, it was an important part of both Theravadan and Tibetan practice for monks to memorize sutras and to repeat them over and over to themselves. And I even read that apparently there are 15 monks alive today who know the Pali Canon by heart. That's what it said on the internet, so it must be true. And there are also definitely people who now who can recite the Dhammapada and who've memorized that, which is less than 100 pages long, which is a lot different from 16,000. And apparently it takes about 2 hours to recite the entire Dhammapada. In one of the early texts it says, whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind. So even if you don't succeed in committing a text to memory, it's a beneficial practice to try. It gets it into your bones. None of us here will be memorizing the Pali Canon. We won't even be memorizing the Dhammapada. But I encourage you to choose one four-line verse somewhere in the Dhammapada and commit it to memory. Saying it to yourself over and over will be a beneficial practice. So I'm going to read through chapter 6 and 7, as I said, and make some comments. So chapters, I'm using Gil Fronsdale's edition, and chapter 6 is on page 20, and it's verse 76. So I'll just read. Like someone pointing to treasure is the wise person who sees your faults and points them out. Associate with such a sage. Good will come of it, not bad, if you associate with one such as this. Let one such as this advise you, instruct you, and restrain you from rude behavior. Such a person is pleasing to good people, but displeasing to the bad. Do not associate with evil friends. Do not associate with the lowest of people. Associate with virtuous friends. Associate with the best of people. Now I just want to interject that that's what we get to do in our Sangha. We're all, aren't we all great here? We're associating with such wonderful, wise people. And we help each other. And we're all regular people too. We're the best of people, but we're also ordinary people. And we're sharing our concerns and our wishes for alleviating suffering so we can help each other be wise. That's one of the great things about Sangha. One who drinks in the Dharma sleeps happily with a clear mind. The sage always delights in the Dharma taught by the noble ones. So those are the first four verses in chapter 6, and they're all on the same topic of associating with wise ones. Going on, irrigators guide water, fletchers shape arrows, carpenters fashion wood, sages tame themselves. As a solid mass of rock is not moved by the wind, so a sage is unmoved by praise or blame. As a deep lake is clear and undisturbed, so a sage becomes clear upon hearing the Dharma. Virtuous people always let go. They don't prattle about pleasures and desires. Touched by happiness and then by suffering, the sage shows no sign of being elated or depressed. And I'm going to read you Tanisaro's translation of that. I don't know if it's Tanisaro or Tanisaro. Does anybody know? Tanisaro? Okay, this is Tanisaro's translation of the same verse, which is 83. Everywhere, truly, those of integrity stand apart. They, the good, don't chatter in hopes of favor or gains. When touched now by pleasure, now pain, the wise give no sign of high or low. So verse 83 is about letting go and about not having preferences between pleasure and pain, which is a tall order. And it's a challenging thing to try to do. And tonight I want to explore our relationship to physical pain, although I acknowledge that there are many, many forms of suffering. But in Zen, pain in the legs tends to be part of the practice. You're supposed to stay still like a rock, even when your knees hurt. For years, I sat in half lotus, and it was mostly okay, except for when I was in Sesshin, and then I sometimes moved. In 1996, I was Shuso with Reb Anderson at Green Gulch, and I sat in half lotus, facing out, feeling as though I really had to stay still because I was Shuso and I was supposed to be an example of practice. So I sat through more pain than I had ever sat through before. I noticed that sometimes if you stayed still and waited, the sensation of pain receded. I noticed how sometimes when you move to get more comfortable, the pain just follows you, so there's no getting away from it. I noticed that sometimes I could say to myself, this is a physical sensation that we call pain. Don't add the second arrow. Don't tell yourself stories about it, that it will never end, that you're a bad person for minding it, that it's going to disable your body and maybe even your mind. It's just what it is, a temporary sensation in your knee. But sometimes I had to move. I just had to. It felt like it wasn't even a choice. My body took over making the choices and insisted that I assume a completely different position, like hugging my knees to my chest with my feet flat on the floor, on the zabutan in front of me, which was quite comfortable. And that worked for a while. That position, I mean, I wasn't in pain, but I certainly wasn't in a zazen position. So this was troubling me, this pain. And in Dokusan, I talked to Reb about it, and I said, what is the point of this? Why struggle so much with pain? And I didn't, you know, we have enough pain already, and what kind of weird religious practice is this that tells us to sit in pain? And wouldn't I be able to meditate better if I was more comfortable while I was meditating? And actually, in my case, that turned out to be true, I would say. And Reb said, well, what are you going to do when you face intense pain in the future, which surely will happen? And I said, well, I know there will be pain in the future, but why choose more pain now? All the more reason not to choose pain now, because I'll be getting it later anyway. And he said, sitting with pain now will help you tolerate the pain that will come in the future. But I still felt, well, I'll cross that bridge when I come to it. And that was kind of my approach. But I admired Reb, I respected him, but it just didn't feel like my path. And now I think about my friend Walter, who died at least 20 years ago, and he used to practice a lot at Green Gulch. He was a really wonderful Dharma brother. And he sat in a chair, and he had serious back pain that he dealt with. And one time after Sesshin, he told me that he hadn't moved, because you're not supposed to, he hadn't moved in spite of the pain, and that he had experienced a great opening in that Sesshin. And he told me, no pain, no gain. So that gave me pause. And another experienced practitioner I knew, who also was at Green Gulch in those days, had to move to a chair temporarily after surgery and until his knee healed, and he said that he missed his pain, and he couldn't sit as well because the pain brought him into the present moment. So I cite those two examples of people who have a different attitude towards pain in meditation than I do. But as I said, I felt these other feelings about, I did discover how much of the pain is extra when we're sitting and how much of it we kind of add on to our thinking, and that we get scared by it and we think it's never going to end, and to just say, oh, what is this like right now, makes it a little bit more bearable. Some years later, Reb had a serious accident, and he was badly injured. And I thought then of our conversation, and I thought, I was glad for his sake, that, and I hoped, well, maybe it's not so bad for him because he's trained himself very well. The last time I did a practice period at Tassajara in 2019 with Kathy and Norman and a bunch of us from Every Day Zen, I was sitting pretty comfortably, either in a chair or on my meditation bench. I was sitting pretty regularly in a chair by that time, and I also sometimes used the bench. And I was not in pain. I was comfortable. Relatively speaking, I was comfortable for the whole 3 months of the practice period, except for some back pain that would come and go. And I had plenty of mental pain, but physical pain wasn't bad. And I even looked forward to sitting zazen. Maybe all of you look forward to sitting zazen all the time, but sometimes when you can get, well, I need a break. But anyway, I really liked it. And I remember a good feeling that came over me one day, having to do with the sense of keeping still, which was that I felt just like a particular boulder that I was very fond of that was on the side of the path to the bathhouse. Maybe some of you can remember a boulder. There's a couple of good boulders there. Anyway, I thought of this particular one, and I felt like I was that boulder. I was just sitting. I just felt like I was this granite blob on the cushion, completely stable on the cushion. And I was like a boulder, except that I was a boulder who was breathing and sort of slightly swelling and shrinking with each breath. But otherwise, I was a boulder. And it was just a great feeling. And so you can get that feeling of stillness. It helps to not be moving around, but you can get that feeling of stillness without being rigid about not moving. And so the sense of just being present and being there still is possible. So here's another piece of my story, which about pain, and I hope I haven't talked about this too much here. I don't think I have. But when I broke my leg in a cabin in the woods this past September, I lay in the floor as still as possible because the slightest twitch caused really intense pain. And an old friend was with me there, thank goodness, and he called an ambulance. And when the EMTs came, they told me they were going to have to lift me up in a blanket sling to carry me up the narrow trail through the woods to the ambulance. And I knew that the shifting of the blanket sling was going to be agonizing. And I said, well, I'm warning you, I'm going to scream. I hope that's okay. And one of the EMTs said, well, as long as you don't hit us. And I laughed. They were great. And I was able to laugh. And then they put me in the sling, and the pain was unbelievable. It was off the charts. And I thought, oh, now I know what they mean by a 10. And I always hate it when they ask you that. What's your pain level? And usually I just think, well, I don't know. It just hurts. But this time I knew what level it was. Anyway, and I screamed, and I screamed, and it was really helpful, and I noticed that it helped, and I noticed that the louder I screamed, the more it helped, because I was focusing my attention on really screaming. And my friend who was with me said he couldn't believe how loud I screamed. And I even said, part of me said to myself, well, you're supposed to be brave. You're a Zen student, and you should be brave. And then there I was screaming, and I said to myself, well, this is me being brave. This is how I'm getting through this experience. And it got me through, and it helped me. And I didn't think it was going to go on forever. So, and once I got to the ambulance, the worst was over. But during that experience, I had a kind of a moment of realization of, oh, I'm a human being. This is what it is to be a human being. That's what they mean when they say life is suffering. But I felt like I had sort of joined a club of humans who really felt pain. And I know that, you know, people all over the world feel a lot of pain. And I thought, and worse than me. And I thought of children in Gaza getting their legs amputated without any anesthesia. And I just thought, this is a quality of life that visits us in different ways and visits different people in different ways at different times. But this is something hard about being a human being, and the feeling of sort of solidarity with other humans was kind of great in spite of all the agony. Anyway, then when we got to the hospital, I got morphine, I had surgery, I stayed in the hospital for a week. And it was this wonderful little hospital in Willits, a very good hospital up in Mendocino County. And then I came home, and I've been recovering at home ever since. And another effect of this episode was that it made me really grateful. I was grateful that my friend was there in the cabin with me. I was grateful that he had a cell phone that had juice in it. I was grateful for the EMTs, the surgeon, the nurses, the CNAs. All of them were people who, miraculously, their job seemed to be to help me, and they didn't even know me. How amazing. And they were really acting like they liked doing it, and they wanted to do it. So that was pretty incredible. And I'm grateful for the fact that I'm healing now and getting better. So I'm telling you this story not as a complaint or not to make you feel sorry for me, but because I learned from it, and I learned that I'm human and that I'm impermanent. And when one of my favorite cups falls on the floor and breaks, I say, oh, the cup was already broken, which is a thing I learned from Sam to say to yourself. It's kind of become a joke at our house when anybody says break something, then they say, oh, the glass was already broken, or the whatever it was already broken. But in this case, I learned that, oh, one of my favorite legs has broken. And actually, my whole body is already broken. Not one of my favorite legs has broken. One of my favorite legs is already broken. And my whole body is already broken because I'm impermanent. And that's what happens. So I think it was thanks to my Zen training that I was able to have this observer part of me that was there giving me a little bit of help through this difficult time, and standing back a little bit and able to laugh at the joke and able to think of others and able to somehow, and able to keep screaming. You know, there was some part of me that knew what I was doing and was there doing it as best I could. I haven't spoken about mental and emotional pain, which is perhaps a more engaging concern for you as it is for me. And I'm not talking about that tonight, but I think a lot of the same principles apply, that we're human, we suffer, and that there's a lot of love around us that we can try to remember, and that many wise sages are taking different forms to help us, and that we can maybe learn a little bit to disconnect from this suffering. So what does all this have to do with the Dhammapada? The Dhammapada takes an extreme position contrasting the sage and the fool. But I don't believe that the words of the Buddha are saying that if you are not an awakened sage, then you are a fool. These stark contrasts are a rhetorical device. They are not actually meant And they are actually meant to encourage us. Buddha was talking to humans, his monks and nuns, and his words are still speaking to humans. These humans here in the room with us together and online, they're speaking to us. Buddha is encouraging us to move in the direction of the sage, to loosen our grip on suffering. And this path is my own and your own, and each one of us finds the way that is right for us, the way to walk the path in the direction of freedom. When it was the right time for me to stop sitting on the floor and sit in a chair, I sat on a chair. And we're responsible for our own training, as the Dhammapada keeps reminding us. You can work on your relationship with pain in your own way and trust your own way and your own path. So back to the Dhammapada. We're up to verse 84. A person who would not wish for success by unethical means, not for the sake of oneself, not for the sake of others, not with hopes for children, wealth, or kingdom, is a person of virtue, insight, and truth. That reminds me of one of the lines in the Metta Sutta that says, may one not desire great possessions even for one's family. Few are the people who reach the other shore. Many are the people who run about on this shore. I can kind of see all these people running back and forth on the beach, waving their arms around, and saying, help, we want to get to the other side, come and help us. That's what we're doing. But those who are in accord with the Dharma, with the well-taught Dharma, will go beyond the realm of death, so hard to cross. Giving up dark ways, sages cultivate the bright. They go from home to homelessness, to the solitude so hard to enjoy. There they should seek delight, abandoning sensual desires, having nothing. Sages should cleanse themselves of what defiles the mind. So those two verses, 86 and 87, well, and 88, remind me of Layman Pang, who in the 8th century in China, he was a fairly wealthy merchant, and he was studying with the various Zen masters, and all of a sudden he just thought, okay, I'm done with this life, and he put all his possessions into a boat, and he filled it with stones and sank it in the river. And that was the end of that. And then he gave his house away to be a temple. And then he and his wife and children were without a home, and he and his daughter, Ling Zhao, traveled around all over visiting different scholars and Zen scholars and Zen teachers and masters and studying the Dharma. And there are wonderful stories about them doing that. And they were very happy doing that. So the last verse in chapter 6 is, those who fully cultivate the factors of awakening, give up grasping, enjoy non-clinging, and have destroyed the toxins, are luminous and completely liberated in this life. So the good news is there in the last line, completely liberated in this life. So we can be liberated in this life. We don't have to wait until after we die. In this life that we're living right now on the planet, we can find freedom. Or that's what arhats do. And this line is a very good lead-in to chapter 7, called the Arahant in Gil Fronsdale's book. And arahant is the Pali word, and we might be used to using to the word arhat, which is a Sanskrit word, and it refers to a holy one who has completed the journey of the path of Dharma and has come to the end and found some freedom and can inspire us to try to go in the same direction. So now I'll read verses from the chapter 7. And this is verse 90 we're up to. For someone at the journey's end, freed of sorrow, liberated in all ways, released from all bonds, no fever exists. The mindful apply themselves. They don't amuse themselves in any abode. Like swans flying from a lake, they abandon home after home. Like the path of birds in the sky, it is hard to trace the path of those who do not hoard, who are judicious with their food, and whose field is the freedom of emptiness and signlessness. Like the path of birds in the sky, it is hard to trace the path of those who have destroyed their toxins, who are unattached to food, and whose field is the freedom of emptiness and signlessness. So, it reminds me of the saying, leave no traces. Mel Weitzman used to say, leave no traces. And I took it to mean then to clean up after yourself, don't litter, which is true. I think it does mean that. And it's also something more broader than that, to be like the holy ones who just fly through the open sky, not leaving any traces there either. Also, the birds flying in the sky and leaving no traces that are spoken of here remind me of Dogen in A Buddha and a Buddha, where he writes, I'm going to read from it, and it's one of my favorite things. So, only a Buddha and a Buddha. There has been a saying since olden times, no one except a bird follows a bird's trace. When a bird flies in the sky, beasts do not even dream of finding or following its trace. As they do not know that there is such a thing, they cannot even imagine this. However, a bird can see traces of hundreds and thousands of small birds having passed in flocks, or traces of so many lines of large birds having flown south or north. Those traces may be even more evident than the carriage tracks left on a road or the hoof prints of a horse seen in the grass. In this way, a bird sees birds' traces. I guess they can see each other's traces because they know where they're going somehow. And also those metaphors, those traces may be even more evident than the carriage tracks left on a road. That metaphor is right in the first verse of the Dhammapada. I don't know if you remember, but it's about, I can't remember the context of the metaphor. How a cart, yeah, Michael.
As the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox.
Yeah, but what is doing it as? What is the? It's our minds or something. Vigilance. Oh. Right. Oh, I'm looking in the wrong chapter. Yes. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. Yeah. Sort of like the law of karma. One thing leads to another. Okay, anyway, going on a little bit more with Dogen. So a bird sees bird's traces. If you find footprints, all who do not know should search out the trace of the Buddha's path. If you find footprints, you should investigate whether they are the Buddha's. Are these Buddha's footprints or is that a raccoon? On being investigated, the Buddha's trace is known, and whether it is long or short, shallow or deep, is also known. To illuminate your trace is accomplished by studying the Buddha's trace. Accomplishing this is Buddha Dharma. So. So now, there's a little bit more to read here. Sorry. Actually, I'm going to skip along to, I'm just going to skip a few verses and go to verse 98. In village, in forest, in lowland, in highland, delightful is the place where the arahant dwells. Delightful are forests where the public does not delight. There the passion-free delight, not seeking sensual pleasure. Well, the verse before that, delightful is the place where the arahant dwells. And this is so wonderful to know that this happens in the village, that we can follow this path in village, in forest, in lowland, in highland. And a village here, I think, means, you know, in town, in society, with other people around us. So we might even say for us, in the city or in the wilderness. And That's a really good piece of news for us too. We don't, even though this book is constantly referring to forest practice and solitary practice, it's hard for us to all do that. We're here in the village, and we can practice here too. So it's possible to become free in this life. And we can aspire to it, and we can aspire to following the path of the arhats. And the Dhammapada doesn't say this, but we know that we can also experience flashes of freedom and glimpses of awakening, even in the midst of a busy day. So it's not all of a sudden you're enlightened and from then on it stays like that. We come and go in and out of our awakening all the time. That's how we think of it in Zen. I think that's not exactly how the Dhammapada is describing it, but we can extend it to our lives now and to these more brief glimpses in our regular lives. So now I want to do a little exercise with you, which is to memorize all of us together verse 98. And we're going to do this by, I'm going to say, you're going to just repeat after me, that's all you have to do. So, in village, in forest,
in
lowland, in highland.
Okay,
we're going to take those lines again. In village, in forest,
in
lowland or highland.
Low,
now we're going to take both of them. In village, in forest, in lowland, in highland.
In
forest, in lowland or highland. Delightful is the place
where the arahant dwells.
Delightful is the place
where the arahant dwells.
Delightful is the place where the arahant dwells. Okay, let's do both of those last lines again. Delightful is the place where the arahant dwells.
Delightful is the place where the arahant dwells.
Now we're going to do the whole thing, and we'll do it a couple of times. Now, for the first two lines are about where, okay? In village, in forest, in lowland, in highland. Delightful is the place where the arahant dwells. Now, put away your books, don't peek, and we'll say it again. And we'll talk about where first. Okay, and I'm not going to peek either. In village, in forest, in lowland or highland, Delightful is the place where the Arahant dwells. Okay, now you got it. You can say it to yourself every morning and every evening for 10 times, and you'll have it for the rest of your life. All right. So, and the homework is that I'm giving, even though I'm not teaching next week. Norman's here next week, right? Okay, so for next week, memorize one verse of your own choosing from the Dhammapada. And if you do that, when we get together again, I'll warn Norman, you can say it to the group. So,
a particular chapter? Or
any chapter anywhere in the book. Something that speaks to you that you would like to be able to carry with you to help you. Like now I can remember that in village and in forest, in highland, lowland or highland, delightful is the place where the Arahant dwells. So wherever I go, as I seek to be an Arahant, it can be a delightful place, even if it's in town. So now we're going to divide up into triads, and I guess, if anybody wants to leave, this is the time to, well, not here, but online. Don't leave from here, please. I might have my feelings hurt if you walked out the door right now. No. And so the question is, what is your experience of living without a fixed home, of living rootless? What about like long-term traveling or, anyway, have you found some freedom ever in a kind of traceless path? And have you lived with the sense that home is wherever you are? That's a lot of talk. I'll go back to just say, what is your experience of living without a fixed home? Have you lived with the sense that home is wherever you are? When have you lived with the sense that home is wherever you are?